come up on a tight wire.
I'm in Studio A, not Studio B, and I'm sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Daniel Chacon, and I am also in Studio A, sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz. Sorry, but it's that this studio is so weird. I mean, where's Studio B? I want to be back.
Well, we'll get it back soon.
You know what's weird about it? Is you don't get internet in this room.
Nevertheless, welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We have a great show for you today. We have a writer who's really kind of unique. I don't think we could call him a poet. I don't think we can call him a fiction writer. I think we just call him a writer. And he has his book out that we're going to talk about called Unlucky Lucky Tales. And it's really kind of a strange, lovely little book. And we're going to have him on the show, and he's going to be joined by his agent, his editor, his publisher, and his wife, Irene Villar, who is an author herself.
So stay tuned for another edition of Words on a Wire.
You know, the first time I ran into Daniel Granbois, I was in Fresno. He's a good friend of TZ Hernandez, Tim Z. Hernandez, who, you know, is also a writer. And he invited me to Daniel's reading. You know, he was reading these wonderful, wonderful little tales. And I've followed him ever since, and so I'm just really glad to see this book came out, and I'm glad to have him on the show. So, Ben, what are you up to these days? Are you writing?
I'm working on a new novel.
This is going to be a great one, I could tell. Every book you write gets better and better. What is this one called?
I don't have a title yet, but stay tuned for that one.
Oh, you know, I love Ben's titles. You know, one of the things that I'd like to do someday is write a found poem based on your titles. Carry Me Like Water, House of Forgetting. You just got such great titles. And now with your new book that just came out, which we'll be talking about in a few weeks, Everything Ends and Begins at the Kentucky Club.
Everything begins
and ends at the Kentucky Club. Thank you. You know what I think you could do? You could take all your titles, line them up, start right here, and I think they would reach all the way around the globe.
And on that note,
we'll be right back. Today, we are welcoming a married couple, both writers, but we're going to talk about a book by Daniel Granbois that just came out. Today, we're talking to Irene Villar and Daniel Granbois. Irene Villar is an editor, a literary agent, and an author of several books dealing with national and generational trauma and women's reproductive rights. Daniel Granbois is the author of the Indie Next Notable Book and Believer Book Award Reader Survey Selection, Unlucky Lucky Days by Boa Editions, the art novel The Hermaphrodite, an hallucinated memoir illustrated by Alfredo Benvenides Bedoya, and the omnibus Unlucky Lucky Tales. He holds an MFA in poetry from Bennington College, lives in Colorado, and tours extensively in North America and Europe with the band Slim Cessna's Auto Club. Welcome to the show.
I'm holding the beautiful book of Unlucky Lucky Tales, which is a sequel, I take it, from your first Unlucky Lucky Tales.
Unlucky Lucky Days.
Yeah. I know it's part of a series, and we'll get to that later. But I really love the pieces. They're playful, and they're meditative, and they're serious, but they're also whimsical as well, and you seem to put all of these things together really well. But one of the things I'm curious about, and I really love the illustrations by Fidel Sclavo.
Yes.
They're really incredible, and I think they really add something to the book. They add a kind of feeling or a kind of atmosphere, ambiente, to the book, which I think is really lovely, and because they're also whimsical, and yet he's a quite serious artist, and also there's some loneliness in this book as well. So I was going to ask you about how you put together that, because I think that you really want to talk about human experience in a different way than a lot of writers are doing today. Can you talk a little bit about that? I don't even know if you're even really working in a genre, in a defined genre, anyway.
I don't even really know genre. I just write what I write, and In fact, these things that many people call prose poems, when I first began writing them, I didn't know there was such a thing as a prose poem. I just wrote what I wrote. And it's the same with talking about the different ways it might present the human condition. That it's not something that consciously is set forth, that I set forth to do. It's just, you know, what comes out. And, you know, luckily I have Irena here reading everything I write daily and helping me shape that a little bit and helping me, you know, have confidence in that voice and in what comes out. Because she really has the editor's brain that I lack, and I might not, you know, I might be able to stir these things out, but I might not have the confidence to put them out there without her.
And are you comfortable if someone would say, this is really a book of short fables, would you be comfortable with that kind of label?
Yeah, I'm comfortable with any label. And it's the same with the band I play in, Slim Cessna's Auto Club. No one knows what to call it, and there's a million different labels. And I'm happy with any label, whatever works for you. And to me, it doesn't have to be short stories or prose poetry or what people call PP/FF, which is the line in between them, or anything else, or fables or fairy tales. It has all of those things. You know, I guess the only time you really need to distinguish a little better is if you're teaching in front of a class and you're trying to make a point or something and you're trying to fit it into this area or that area or that line between. But
I got your first book, Unlucky Lucky Days, which came out with Boa. And Boa used to only do poetry. And in fact, this was the first time I learned that Boa had done, well, I don't know if we can call it fiction. And I noticed a lot of their collections. I've since read some of their collections. A lot of them are like this. But how does this Unlucky Lucky come about? Because I know you have this one, and then you have your very latest one, which is put out by Texas Tech Press. But how did this unlucky lucky dichotomy come about?
And there's even more unlucky luckies, because this book is made of three books: the original Unlucky Lucky Days from Boa Editions, and then the one that I wrote after that, Unlucky Lucky People, which really became my MFA thesis, and then Unlucky Lucky Book. So we just kind of put them all together and made that.
Originally you were going to go with three separate books. Now that you mentioned it.
Yeah, and Pitt Poetry Series, which is the best publisher for prose poetry. They have Russell Edson and David Shoemate, and their editor Ed Ochester, who did the foreword, ended up doing the foreword to my book. Was going to take on Unlucky Lucky People, but then as two big name prose poets, Russell Edson and David Shoemate, they both turned in manuscripts.
Oh, no.
Then Irene jumped in and said, well, let's put them all together and make one nice book. And that's also what the reason for the illustrations is, because Irene's series, The Americas, is all about the, you know, kind of collaboration or influence between across the Americas. And my book would not have fit there unless we got a South American illustrator and so therefore had the conversation between us.
Daniel, I have a question for you. You've been referred to as the Dr. Seuss for adults. I remember when I was a kid, Dr. Seuss is probably, you know, one of my favorite writers. I love the imagination. I love that he could take you absolutely anywhere and make up words and things like that. Is there some influence with Dr. Seuss?
You know, there could very well be, and there certainly is from fairy tales and folk tales of all kinds as well, and children's books. Besides reading a lot of science, I get a lot more out of those kinds of books than most fiction and literary stuff. For example, The Tales of Uncle Remus, or Kipling's Just So Stories, mm-hmm. or an amazing book called The Magic Pudding. Can't quite recall the author's name now, but...
When you sit down to write, do you tell yourself, I'm going to write a book with all of these things in it? So are you writing a book, or are you just going to write the different pieces and then just put them together in a book?
Each of those things happen at different times. In the beginning, and maybe through the first half of the writing process, or even more, I'm just writing pieces, and then based on what's coming out, you know, you can see the shape of a book at some point. Like Unlucky Lucky Days had many more tales that involved animals and inanimate objects, plant life, and things like that. So at one point, it became obvious that I should organize it in those categories, you know, the people and the animals and the inanimate objects. And for a while, those were going to be the three main groups in the book. And then that led me to write, you know, okay, I only have five of people, so I got to write another one with people, or I only have...
Right.
But then it turned out that we organized it in terms of days of the week instead of those. But that was the organizing factor for a while during the writing.
What is your relationship to the title Unlucky Lucky?
There's a couple things I'd say about that. To me, that's just the definition of being alive. Basically, you know, if you're alive, you feel that dichotomy that it's the luckiest thing in the world and maybe one of the unluckiest things. and then also, just to go back to how it came up with these pieces and how it came to be something that I had latched onto it. The first of these pieces was written when Irene and I were on our honeymoon and we had my older kids with us. We were in Maine and we had driven a long ways from the airport, just had our car full of groceries and then it was like nearing midnight and we reached the place we were supposed to stay in this tiny little town in Stonington, Maine. And the woman wasn't there and we had no way to get in and so we parked by this graveyard, which was where we thought her place was, and we could find her, and we thought we might be sleeping in the car with our groceries. But we started telling stories, and it was one of those situations where everyone gives the storyteller one word, and then he has to create a story. one of them, you know, that I was given the words mansion, executioner, and turtle, and the story I made up about it, you know, everyone liked enough, especially Irene, encouraged me to write it down. And then in the writing of it, it became, you know, one of the lines was about this turtle who was an executioner, you know, having this unlucky, lucky day by the river. And so that story became called that, and then eventually the whole collection became called that, making the day into days, and then the unlucky lucky stuck with me.
Wow, that's a great story. We're talking to Daniel Granbois, author of Unlucky Lucky Tales, which has just came out with Texas Tech University Press, and Irene Villar, his editor, partner.
And Daniel, you talk a little bit about your writing process. What for you is the hardest thing about writing?
For me, it's being in a place where your head is clear. I mean, it hasn't been hard for me anymore after years of habituation, but it used to be something where the main thing I had to do was put myself in the right place. And I'd, you know, years ago, I remember I was living in Virginia at the time, and I would walk around the neighborhood talking to myself, trying to put out all the thoughts that were going to keep me from being able to open up to the place I needed to open up to. Any worries, any concerns, any fears, any things like that. But, you know, now when it just becomes habit that you go and you sit, at either your computer or your writing tablet or whatever, if you just go sit there every day, it's easier and easier not to have to clear your head and put yourself there because you're just automatically there. One of the things I do now, though, is if I get a little nervous, I've been working on a play, and that's also an unlucky lucky. It's called Unlucky Lucky Bodies. sometimes you get a little nervous about going down there and facing the page if you don't quite have any thoughts of what might be coming next. And I realize that I can fool myself into getting there by sitting at the computer first, kind of looking at a few things, looking at emails, maybe going on to Amazon and getting into some light bulbs or something, and you know, you kind of pretend like you're not actually going to get to the writing, and then I might just sneak over an open word here, and then pretty soon you're writing. And so,
when you write, do you oftentimes write without having any idea of what you're going to write, and then suddenly you just kind of end up somewhere?
Yeah, you know, especially for these kind of pieces, I definitely do that a lot of the time. Almost every time I sit down and the way I used to start them is I'd kind of put myself in the right place, and then I'd kind of look around the room. You know, one time I saw a carved piece of log and, you know, on a wall when we were staying in the Bahamas, and then I started writing about that, or my daughter's plastic giraffe, or I might have to flip through some pages of a book and a certain phrase will just set me off onto something. And, you know, but once you get going, you know, there are times when you then are shaping it or coming up from the outside with more ideas as to where it should go. And if I write longer pieces like this play, then yes, there are times when I come down ahead of time, I have to keep everything that's already happened in mind and have some idea as to where I might be going that day. And that might be why I was getting more nervous and having to fool myself into opening the page. So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, what you just described is like a child just sitting in front of a blank piece of paper with crayons with no idea what they're going to do. And then they come up with these incredible, incredible works of art. And of course, when I say you write like a child, I mean that as a compliment. I mean,
I love that.
Access the imagination in ways that a lot of adults cannot.
Yes. That's what people have written about in some reviews. And also, I went to talk with my brother's teaches writing, and he was at Sacramento State, and one of his students there, when I went to talk, wrote a letter to him afterwards saying that it was like that everything else seems like it's you know, adult learning and adult writing is like from the outside in, you know, with all the ideas and all the thinking. And that, you know, your brother Daniel's writing was like a child from the inside out, where you never have any idea where it's going, and yet it all makes sense and somehow creates. I think she said something about it somehow creates things in your mind instead of just naming them or something like that. But.
Well, I think you're really able to create a world in very few words, and so in that way, is it related to the music that you do?
I certainly think the sound of it is related to the music, and you know, my ear's always been the sense that is the most on, always on, and always taking things in. I can't shut it off, so, you know, people's chewing food with their mouths open drives me crazy. I can't turn my ears off, and music has always been such a big part of satisfying that sense, and I think that, yeah, the sound of things is definitely a part of how my pieces are written.
I suppose the lyrics always go with the music if it's working well together. It creates this tone. It creates this mood. And yeah. You create this mood without music. There's just the words. And you create this atmosphere. And I think that's what a good song does. It creates this atmosphere.
That's beautiful. I like that.
And I wonder if you do that with your music. I don't know your music.
Well, with the music, I don't write the songs on the bands I play, and I write the bass lines, and I, you know, any backup vocal parts.
But those bass lines are very interesting. I think they would fit here with what he's saying, yeah.
Which was your first love, music or writing?
Well, that's a tough question, because certainly the first love was music. I mean, when I was 5 years old, I got my first Elvis Presley record from a garage sale across the street, and I've been hooked ever since. I mean, I probably spend at least one day, every day of my life, I've spent sitting there like the guy in the Max Hell tape ad with my eyes closed and sitting back in a chair listening to a whole album. I'm a very big music fan, and it really takes me places. And I went to an Elvis concert the year before he died when I was 11 years old, and I cried like a teenage girl the whole time. I mean, that's how much. So that's the first love. But if you talk about what I spend my time doing and what actually gives me the most, fills me up the most, gives me the most satisfaction, I mean, I go on tour with this band. You know, recently we did 100 days of touring within a year, and it is wonderful while you're performing. The rest of touring is kind of a grind. But there's something that I get much more from my daily writing, and so I would have never expected it. I didn't turn to reading or writing until I was in college. I wasn't a reader at all. So it wasn't something planned or expected or desired, but it somehow turned into the thing that somehow worked best with my natural voice and my natural abilities. And with even with my personality, I'd rather be sitting at home in my room, you know, thinking thoughts than sitting in a van crossing Europe and not getting sleep and not eating what I want to eat. You know?
We've been talking to Irene Villar and Daniel Grandbois, and they're married. They're both writers. Sounds like a beautiful partnership you two have.
Yes, well, good luck on all your future projects, and thank you so much for being on Words on a Wire. It's been a real pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you so much. For
our poem of the week, we have Abigail Carl Clausen. She is an MFA candidate here at the University of Texas, El Paso, in our bilingual creative writing program. She teaches first-year composition and creative writing. She grew up in rural West Texas, like the community of Seminole, home to large settlements of Low German-speaking Mennonites who have immigrated to the area from Canada and Mexico since the late 1970s. Her work has appeared in the Center for Mennonite Writing Journal, 491, Border Senses, Lala Tamba, New Border, an anthology, and the upcoming Desnudas en el Desierto anthology. And also, another upcoming poem is going to appear in the Rio Grande Review. She lives with her husband, Jonathan, in downtown El Paso, and is currently working on her first book of poetry.
In the following poem, Walking in Colonia Rubio, It's a part of a collection based on my experiences living among the Mennonite communities in Seminole, Texas in the 1990s and early 2000s, as well as oral histories I collected from some of my closest friends and their parents, from people who would later become family members through marriage. While we ate fasba, a traditional Mennonite meal, around the kitchen table and cracked sunflower seeds on the back porch, they shared their childhood memories and coming-of-age stories from the years they spent living in old colony communities in Mexico near Cuauhtémoc, Chihuahua. Walking in Colonia Rubio addresses one woman's return to the old colony community many years after choosing a life outside of the community. I'm thankful for my opportunity to be a witness to the past and present among friends and family in Seminole and in Mexico, and this poem and the collection springs from that gratitude. Walking in Colonia Rubio. Laundry day, Monday and Friday, by hand I smell the sun, soap powder and crunch up and down the dusted path, packed flat by steel wheels of unpainted wooden trailers, propelled by bareback mares in my black caliche strap sandals, Grosspapa bought in Casas Grandes. The weight of socks in my soul makes the hens fight and the rooster chuckle before I kick him away from the jagged hem of a pink and white dress I stitched for myself for the first time. The flowers cut from the same fabric as my mother and sisters. We bought 15 yards at the Dicha Walmart to match our new straw hats, wide ribbons around the brim so we could tell them apart from the ones our brothers wore, with their striped and solid knipsaham and coveralls, before my oldest brother nailed his outhouse closed. Our father said they were going to hell because my cousins pissed inside, buckets heavy, the well water on green tile. Before we snuck out under the summer moon to play volleyball outside the neighbor's barn, until preachers in black coats and bexa split and gutted our ball with a crowbar and stomped the devil's music, a portable radio that only played corridos from Cuauhtémoc and weather reports from El Valle, with their boots and the Bible. We could not decipher their shapes, but we knew they demanded silence. The corpse, crucified, sagged on the clothesline, and I walk that line to recover the stains cranked from that rusted handle, where I always crouched over a trough of Wranglers bought once a year cheap in El Paso, and polyester aprons we ironed Tuesdays before tractors had rubber tires, and before I smoked cheap cigarettes with wild Mennonite boys who drove flatbed pickups and drank warm tecates while they turned their eyes away from our waist-high panties strung like flags of surrender.
You really paint a portrait of a world, and there's an immediacy to this poem that's really lovely. Thank you for reading that, Abby.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. This is Benjamin Alida Sines, and for this week's Poetic License, I have some reflections on choices. On Tuesday, November 6th, I walked into my local polling station and cast my vote for the next president of the United States. I also cast my vote for several local initiatives. Choice. We all have choices. Or maybe that term is overused and greatly misunderstood. You can be anything you want to be. Why, you might even grow up to be president. We like saying things like that. We want to believe things like that. But is it true? Really? We don't like believing that our choices are limited. But they are. I had a choice between two candidates in this past election. Just two. In a country of more than 300 million people, I was presented with only two choices. Just two. I liked one candidate better than the other. But my ideal candidate, my choice, was not on the ballot. My ideal candidate would never get on a ballot. He or she would be too far to the left. I live in a politically moderate country, a country that presents me with more choices of what candy bars I should eat than who I should vote for president. All the things we do, all the choices we make, are limited choices. The clothes we buy are limited by three factors: our income, what's on the rack, and last and least, my taste. The cars we drive are limited by the same factors: what we can afford and what's on the lot. You could say all of our choices are trickle-down choices. Even the idea of happiness is limited. Some people suffer from mental illnesses that prevent them from choosing to be happy. Some days, bad things happen, very bad things. People get killed in accidents. People get killed in movie theaters. People die every day in violent, tragic, and unnecessary incidences. And some people are born in countries that are so poor or so repressive that the idea of happiness is nothing more than a dream. What does it mean to choose to be happy? Do sad sacks really choose to be sad sacks? Or is there something else at play here? We don't choose the countries we were born in. We don't choose the families we were born in either. We don't choose our ethnicities, nor do we choose our gender. I'm not saying that choice is an illusion. What I am saying is that we often overstate the choice thing in our culture. We think like this: poor people are poor because they choose to be. Or people are fat because they choose to be. Or people are gay because they choose to be. People live on the street because they choose to live on the street. People are addicts because they choose to be addicts. The facts are rather more complicated than that. Our choices are often dictated by factors that are often out of our control. So maybe that's it. When we tell ourselves that we choose to live our lives in a particular way and that we are in charge of our own destinies, then we appear to have control over our lives. But do we? I'm not so sure. Every time I hear a parent tell a child that they can grow up to be anything they want to be, that they can grow up to be president, I always smile wryly and think of the last line in The Sun Also Rises. Wouldn't it be pretty to think so? This is Benjamin Alida Sines for Words on a Wire.
Well, thank you, Ben, for your poetic license. We would like to also thank Abigail Carl Clausen for sharing her lovely poem.
And we'd like to thank Daniel Grandbois for being on the show, along with his editor and life partner, Irene Villar.
And don't forget, oftentimes the interviews go longer than the 20 minutes that we're able to air. So look at the KTEP webpage under Words on a Wire, or any of our web pages, Words on a Wire, Radio Blogspot.com, UTEP Creative Writing, Podomatic.com, and you can hear the extended interviews.
Absolutely, because sometimes it does go on longer, and there's many interesting things that we just simply can't put into a half-hour period. So please, if you really like an interview, you can see if there's an extended interview online.
So make sure you join us next week. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sines.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.